And hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Between the Lines. Today, my name is Keith Redmond. Today I'm joined by four representatives of the charity sector, and today we're going to talk about taking care of each other in the recession. I'm joined today by Donald Costello from the Clondalkin Citizens Information Centre, by Eamon Timmins, a spokesperson for Age Action, by Niamh Randall, national spokesperson for the Simon Community, and Audrey Dean, spokesperson for St Vincent de Paul. You're all very welcome here today. Charity in a recession, I suppose, becomes an even more pressing demand on all of your services are going to be undergoing an increased demand in a recession. But just so our listeners understand what each of your charities do, maybe we just go around the table and you could discuss what the work of each of your agencies is. So first of all, we'll go to Donald Costello of the Clondalkin Citizens Information Centre.
Yeah, we are a community-based organisation, but we are state-funded through the Citizens Information Board. We provide information, advice and advocacy to citizens on a wide range of subjects, mostly social welfare related, I'd say about 60%, 65%. Our advocacy work involves doing appeals where we consider somebody has been wrongly turned down for a benefit, and if we can't persuade the deciding officer, we'll take an appeal to the social welfare appeals system. And we also do a lot of employment appeals in relation to employment rights with rights commissioners and the tribunal, the employment, that's all changing now, but the Employment Appeals Tribunal. And we're, you know, usually quite successful at those. We're funded by the state. We have a mixture of paid staff and volunteers. I have over 20 volunteers. We have two centres, one based in Clondalkin and the other in Lucan. And we deal with about 15,000 people a year. And nationwide, I think about 600,000.
Have you seen an increase in demand for your services? Obviously, with more people on social welfare, you would have seen more people coming to avail of your services.
Absolutely. Not only more people, but people with more complex, difficult situations. So I think it's been an increase in both. And also people in a more stressed situation. I think we're certainly noticing the stress and strain that people are going through. Mm.
You mentioned that you help people who've been turned down for social welfare benefits of various different types. The government have been making much play on the fact that they're trying to cut down on what they see as social welfare fraud.
Yeah.
So have you seen an increase, for example, in the number of people being turned down for benefits?
Yes, and a lot of it has nothing to do with fraud. I mean, they're just making life more difficult. By and large, people who are engaged in fraud wouldn't be coming into us because if they're engaged in fraud, they're not going to tell us.
They're hardly going to appeal it.
Yeah, they're hardly going to appeal it. So, illness benefit, for example, people are just getting cut off illness benefit. Mm. We have a situation where people get cut off illness benefit because they don't consider them ill. And then when they go for unemployment benefit, they're told, well, you've got a sick note, you're not available for.
So they're in a catch-22.
They're in a catch-22. Mm. We managed to get a couple overturned recently, but the waiting list now for appeals is about 15 months.
Wow.
So even if you're successful, you're waiting a long time. Now, we do get back money. We have had a lot of back money for people who should never have been turned down in the first place.
But how do they survive in the meantime?
That's it. Because community welfare officer, who isn't as accessible as they used to be, they've now got a new title. They've been completely redone as well. And there was a time when maybe, you know, they'd have more success in getting money from them. But you literally have people with no income.
And we know that self-employed people, for example, in the boom time, a lot of the carpenters, electricians and such would have been self-employed.
Yeah.
And they weren't paying a particular class of PRSI.
That's right.
And therefore they're not entitled to unemployment benefit. Have you seen any formerly self-employed people coming to you for assistance?
Yeah, a lot. They would only get assistance, as you say. They don't get benefit. There has been a little bit of a change. I mean, I know we had a situation where, for example, people who maybe were registered as sole traders, but because they're still registered as in business, they're not technically unemployed, even though they're not. Mm. They're not actually
earning any money.
They're not earning any money or doing anything. Now, in fairness, I think the social welfare have sort of leaned back a little bit on that one. You know, there was a time when you had to almost get your company taken off the register. Mm.
And at what stage does the social welfare system step in for people who are formerly self-employed? Is there any level of safety net for them?
Assistance.
So it's only if they only if they can show they effectively have no assets.
Exactly. It means test of payment. It would be the same as anybody who has been working in the PAYE system but hasn't got enough contributions.
Right.
You try for assistance.
Okay, we'll move on to Eamon Timmins, the spokesperson for Age Action. Eamon, What specifically does Age Action do in the country?
Well, Age Action is a national charity for older people. We're 20 years old this year. And the role of Age Action is to improve policies and services for older people. And we have the ultimate aim of making Ireland the best place in the world in which to grow older, which is a very very ambitious goal. The way we go about it, we're an advocacy organisation at heart. We campaign and we do research and policy work for issues which affect older people and ageing in Ireland. We have an information service, take about 3,000 calls a year. We do care and repair, which is our volunteers going out to people's homes, maybe for older people who are living independently at home, but who may not be able to push a lawnmower or climb up on a chair to change a light bulb. Small tasks to enable people to live independently in their own homes.
Are you state funded?
We receive some state funding. Our funding is through a combination of our charity shops and donations, public donations. We have some philanthropy and corporate donations for some of our projects, we have corporate sponsors, and then we get a core grant from the HSE. Some of our programs are funded for the work we do from various government departments. So, for example, we run a Getting Started computer training course for older people. We train about, I think we've trained about 14,000 people since we started.
The so-called Silver Surfers.
Silver Surfers. We had our Silver Surfer Award on Tuesday. Most remarkable people. The people who won the individual awards last Tuesday in Google headquarters, Google was sponsoring it this year. Quite remarkable. Technology is very important to get people online. It really has huge potential for older people. So we have identified that as one of the big barriers.
It combats the loneliness that some older people can feel and the isolation, doesn't it?
Certainly. It brings people who may be very isolated, very housebound into contact with an entire community around the world, really, people who share their interests, or even just keeping them in contact with their family and friends who may have emigrated or live abroad. Skype is very popular with older people. But even like what Donal has touched on there, it also enables people to access their rights and entitlements. And information is power. And once people they know what they're entitled to and they know their rights, that is important. And technology is many companies are turning solely to their websites as a way of providing information. So it is important to make sure that we get people online. But 80% of over 65s in Ireland do not have IT skills. That is a real challenge going forward. We run lifelong learning groups. We have a global education program for older people in the developing world. And we've started this year. This year is a European Year of Active Aging and Intergenerational Solidarity. We started an intergenerational project, bringing young and old together to work, to learn from each other, to make sure that we don't have that big divide in the community. And we're working with the National Youth Council on that. And we try to challenge age discrimination in society, and we've just finished Positive Aging. We finished yesterday. There are still a few events happening next week, but there's about 1,000 events that have happened around the country. This year we're sponsored by Bluebird Care. And the purpose of Positive Aging Week is to celebrate the fact that we're all growing older, that is something to be celebrated, and also to recognise the contribution which older people have made in the past to our communities, and that's often quite easy to do. But more importantly, and certainly in the current climate, to recognise the contribution which older people are continuing to make to our communities as volunteers, as grandparents, as older workers, as people with great experience in the community who have tremendous civic spirit and want to contribute that to society. One of the barriers is that society can be quite ageist sometimes and tends to write off older people. So one of the things we're trying to do is to tap that huge resource we have of older people in our community.
So we've undervalued the wisdom of older people, haven't
I think we? In modern society, tends to think that what we have now is more important than what we've had in the past. It forgets that we all learn from our mistakes, and there are people in our community who've made lots of mistakes because they've been around longer and do want to share that experience. But I think one of the things we're trying to say to people is that Age Action, while we work with older people, we helped about 30,000 older people last year, it really is a charity which we all have something to benefit from if we intend growing older in this country. And we are trying to build an age-friendly society. And so I think the work of Age Action, sometimes it's easy to say, oh, it's just older people. Unless you're old, you don't need to worry about Age Action. If you intend to grow old in this country, you really should have an interest in the charity.
Okay, we move on now to Niamh Randall, who's the national spokesperson for the Simon community. Niamh, a lot of people would be familiar with the work of the Simon community, but for those who aren't, what would the Simon community do?
Well, the Simon communities have been providing services, working with people who are homeless for over 40 years in Ireland. We now have services in every county in Ireland, and we work with between 4,500 and 5,000 people every year. We work with people who are at risk of homelessness, we work with people who are currently homeless, and we also work with people who have been homeless. And our services range from emergency provision, from outreach teams, soup runs, right through to supporting people to move into appropriate housing and providing the support that they may need to live independently.
And a lot of people would be surprised to think that in the 21st century we still would have a homeless problem. Would it be fair to say that homelessness is not just about four walls and a roof, and there are more complex problems often behind homelessness?
Certainly. I mean, the big issue, though, really is access to appropriate housing and accommodation. However, a lot of people who use services might have additional needs, so we might be talking about mental health issues, physical health issues, sometimes drug and alcohol use. So the key thing, I suppose, we say really is about, it's about housing plus, so it's about housing with those additional supports that could be short-term support to support people to learn budgetary skills, managing a home, or could be broader support, maybe ongoing mental health intervention. So it's always housing plus is what we say.
So the advocacy that the Simon community provide would also be touching on issues such as the Department of Health's mental health budget cuts, and then also addiction counselling and addiction services. So it's a wide-ranging support. It's not just, as I say, the four walls and the roof.
Absolutely, and I suppose what you really need is that interagency or interdepartment response, because it cuts across a range of different departments and responsibilities. So we would work very actively with all government departments and agencies to ensure that we have very comprehensive, complex responses to these issues.
And is the Simon community state-funded?
We would be funded, we'd have some statutory funding, which we supplement through very, very active fundraising activities. And we're really lucky, given the current climate. People are so supportive and remain so supportive. An example would be Dublin Simon Fun Run, which happened yesterday. And 2,000 people took part in that. And it was a fantastic day, really, really positive. And again, just reminding people about the amount of support that we have and the amount of support in terms of tackling homelessness around Ireland.
And this is the last day of Simon Week, isn't it?
It is, yes, yes. Simon Week was very, very successful this year. And what we were doing this year is asking everybody to take a step for Simon. Taking a step for Simon could be a very small or a very big step, depending on what you choose to do. So it could be something like writing to your local TD, speaking to your friends and family about homelessness, a range of different things. And what we've been asking people to do is to visit simon.ie and to pledge to take their step to tackle homelessness.
And what can individuals do to help Simon, apart from obviously making donations?
Well, there's a range of different things, like some of the ones I just mentioned there, being much more proactive around the issue. So maybe speaking to your local TD, writing to your local newspaper, talking to your friends and family, becoming more aware of the issues. But also in terms of volunteering, I mean, we'd have 2,000 plus volunteers helping us in a range of ways every year, whether that's through fundraising activities, it might be supporting the services we provide. We've got befriending and mentoring services. So there's a range of different things people can do to supplement what we're doing.
We've just received a text actually from Jane, who said the Simon community do great work, and I often see them doing their soup runs and talking to people on the street, and they're just so caring, and I'm humbled by it all. So your work is well respected. I move on now finally to Audrey Dean. Audrey represents the St Vincent de Paul, which I would imagine most people would be familiar with, but if you could just go through what the St Vincent de Paul does in this day and age in Ireland.
Well, we're here 150 years. Really, I guess we're the largest charity of social concern in Ireland. Our main, if you could call it, unique selling point is the fact that we have 10,300 volunteers who actually visit people in their own homes in a very discreet, confidential way. And I guess they have a very privileged position in the heart of households who are under stress. And our other speakers have talked about the complexity of that. You can never just put somebody's set of problems, because they're so subjective and so, you know, just particular to them. Excuse me. Sorry about that. So our volunteers do this on a daily basis all around the country. In fact, to be honest, there probably isn't a parish in Ireland that doesn't have an SVP group beavering away somewhere. But we don't just do that. We have very specific education projects. Now, I work personally with a lot of the people involved in education projects, and I personally feel privileged to work with these volunteers who just give up so much of their energy, commitment and motivation, particularly to work with disadvantaged younger people who are either at risk of early school leaving or have already left the school system, and also with adults who could be have low skills, who aren't very attractive to the labour market or getting a job in real life. And they work very, very closely with these people to build up their skills, their confidence, their own self-esteem around, maybe I could go back, maybe I could do some sort of course, maybe I can start this long lifetime journey of just getting more skills. And the ripple effect into families is just amazing when somebody starts that journey.
I must confess an interest here. I was actually a St Vincent de Paul volunteer myself.
Really?
And helped to organise the Vincent de Paul ball one year many moons ago.
Yeah.
I know, it was great fun. But for those people out there who don't understand the motivation behind your organisation and would see, for example, that our social welfare system, as they would see it, would be quite well funded. We have the dole, we have children's allowance, we have rent allowance, we have various forms of supports. Why in that with that safety net there, why is the St Vincent Paul still needed?
Very good question. I guess the reason it's needed is that although we have those things, and in fact I think it's 23 billion this year will have been spent by Minister Burton on social welfare. Now that's right across from pensions to qualified child allowance to whatever else in between, fuel allowances, a whole rake of schemes. In fact, it's a very, very complex terrain. There's a lot of eligibility criteria. People fall in and out of being able to be eligible for schemes. But the real reason is that this is a very expensive country to live in. We do not have the level of investment in our social services that other countries in Europe do, and other countries in Europe are prepared to pay for. So the percentage of GDP that is spent on actually social protection schemes is very low. So you'll end up with people paying for school books, paying to go to the hospital, or paying to go to the doctor if they aren't on social welfare. So the way our system is actually structured means that unless you're on a social welfare benefit, you're paying for a lot of things, and a lot of people just can't afford that.
So just to go back to the budget for the Department of Social Welfare, which you mentioned is 23 billion, we bring in 35 billion in total in our taxes. So we spend 23 billion on social welfare alone. You think that we should spend more?
No, I'm not saying particularly that we should spend more, because let's be honest, everybody needs to be realistic. We're between a rock and a hard place. We're a tiny country on the edge of Europe, and we have messed up big time with regard to regulation and very poor social policies and any sort of public policy over the last decade. So now we are reaping that very bitter harvest, and we're not here to make political points, so I'm not going to get into that. But the big mistakes have been made, big problems have been discovered in the banking system, and we have got to pull that around. But at the same time of pulling that around, we have got to protect those who are vulnerable. And when I say vulnerable, I mean people who are currently on social welfare or who need social welfare schemes. I'm talking about the children, and it's 1 in 9 children who are living in households who are at risk of poverty. Now, you can't afford to have whole generation of children growing up with not enough services to protect their health and well-being and their education.
So just to come back to my question, though, do you think that we should increase the social welfare budget? So we, as I say, we bring in 35 billion. Do you think more should go into social welfare above the 23 billion?
Well, I wouldn't be naive enough to say that more should go into it. What I think we need to do is to act and box very clever and make sure that we prioritise those who are most vulnerable. And that may mean, unfortunately, that other services have to be either cut back or in some way made more effective and efficient. So I have to say...
So in effect, you're saying that we focus our 23 billion budget on the most vulnerable, but as a result of that, we do have to remove some supports and entitlements from other people.
I didn't exactly quite say that. I think I said that we need to be more effective, and I'm aware that there's a whole State Department which is looking at reforms, and they haven't done an extremely effective job so far of having a look at all the public allowances. And maybe we're not here to have a big, long, boring discussion about that.
Oh, we are.
Lovely Sunday morning. Okay, let's go for it. Well, so far, what have we got out of that big, long approach and review of those public service allowances? Not much. So I think we just need to get a bit more outcome oriented. And if we as a society want to protect the most vulnerable, and by those I mean those who have the least money to get through the week, and particularly households with children, they are our future. They have got to be protected. Their health and education and well-being is supremely important, and it shouldn't be at the expense of another very vulnerable cohort, because I'm very sure Eamon Timmins across the table from me will speak very, very articulately on behalf of those older people who are less well off, and particularly the fact that the living allowance, what's that, 770, and it hasn't changed for 10 years. And we all know that there's a whole cohort of older people who are living at home, who are very, very vulnerable. But what I'm trying to say here is that we have got to be very, very clear who we're going to protect. And we have to be very, very efficient about looking at our taxation system, about broadening it, and ensuring that those who can afford do pay.
I received a text message here from Angela, who said that the entitlements that ordinary decent people receive are not enough, and it's because effectively there are scammers in the social welfare system that are getting money they're not eligible for. Now, this is a popular belief out there, maybe a misconception, but would you favour a sterner action by the government in rooting out social welfare fraud?
Well, I think it's interesting that you're, because this is something that comes up, human nature being what it is, nobody wants anybody else to get something that they shouldn't. I mean, I'm one of those people myself, of course, like anybody else. But what I, there's a huge increase in the amount of people who are being shopped for social welfare fraud. So I think people are doing it themselves. I mean, I think, to be honest, that there is, there always is, let's be very honest with each other here, there are always a percentage of people who will scam any system, any society has people like that. And I think that people are less tolerant of that sort of behaviour. And in a way, I genuinely feel that the social welfare department is pretty well adequately resourced to have a look at fraud, and they are doing so. So that's my response to that. I don't think we should be hammering everybody, and I don't think we should be creating more hostility and suspicion in communities, particularly in communities of disadvantage, because that really doesn't get us anywhere. What we really need to be doing is showing solidarity for each other and everybody shouldering what they can of the burden. And that, again, does mean that those who can afford to make more taxation contributions should be doing that.
Okay. If you do want to join in the conversation here, you can text us on 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. And we're going to move on now to the impact that the recession has had on the charity sector. The recession, it said, it's biting hard in the charity sector, where organisations are under increased pressure, demand for their services, but are also having their state funding cut. So if we just come to you, Donal, you mentioned that the Clondalkin Citizens Information Centre is state funded. Have you seen a cut in your funding?
I'd have to say we've been luckier than most. In the first year, was it 2008? We got two cuts. We got a cut in our budget, and then halfway through the year, I got a further cut. No, it was... Those cuts were manageable. Since then, we've maintained our budget. I have to say, we've been one of the few organisations to do that. But there is an increased demand on our services. Our staff can't cope, basically, with the demand that's been put on it. And the only way we've been able to increase our resources is through more volunteers coming in.
Volunteers, yeah.
Which has been one of the positive aspects of this, that we've had a lot of people in the local community just willing to come in and try and help. Without them, we wouldn't have been able to cater for the extra demand. Like, we've gone from around 10,000 to 15,000, as I say, people coming in and spending a lot more time. There was a time when people came in, maybe they're about to retire, little inquiry about their state pension, 5 minutes, there's your booklet, and out they go. That was the query. Now it's a very, very complex thing, which often means people coming back a second, a third, a fourth time. A lot more advocacy work.
As you know, the government are talking about making more cuts in this budget coming up, and I would imagine in the charity sector in general you'd be quite fearful that your budget would be cut. How do you think your organisation will react or cope if there's another cut in this December budget?
It would depend. If it was a very, very small cut, we can make some adjustments. Some of my budget goes on training and other matters that you can make some adjustment to it, because we do a lot of in-house training. But when it comes to the core staff and equipment and all of that, you know, that we need, it would mean a cutback in our services.
Have your staff taken pay cuts?
No.
Would that be an option?
It probably will be at some stage. When the pay cuts took place a few years ago in the state, what was it, 7%, wasn't it? I think public...
Average, 7.5.
Yeah. The Minister at the time said that included the state-funded sector, which would be ourselves, you know. But apparently there was some technical loophole in there, because I actually told the staff that they were getting a 7% cut, and then told them the next day they weren't, which made them very happy, I can tell you.
I can imagine.
But I imagine they're going to do something about that, because there's a lot of people involved in the community and voluntary sector who are state-funded. I think there's about 200,000 of us. But at the moment, no, I have to say, thankfully. I'm sure, I mean, we can keep getting away
with it.
But if others have been cut 7%, I mean, it's going to happen to us.
Yeah. Eamon, Age Action, obviously dealing with some of the most vulnerable people in the country, you'd be quite fearful of a cut in your state funding, but I would imagine that you do get some, you know, have you seen, for example, an increase in the kind of fundraising that you do privately?
Well, looking at the finances, certainly statutory funding has been cut, and we think we took 5-7% last year. It's been what they call salami slicing. They've been salami slicing various programs. To some degree, we can manage that. It's the bigger fear that the projections are much higher for this year, and that would cause us huge difficulties. Our shops, the footfall is up. The revenue from our shops, we have shops in Dunleary, our main shop in Camden Street, and one in Monaghan, and the shops are doing well. The trouble is with stock. If people are donating less because people have less to donate. You know, during the boom times, people would donate more freely. Corporate funding is getting harder, and we have a major care and repair program where the volunteers go to people's homes. That's funded by Irish Life. That funding is due to end next year. They've been incredibly generous, but they've given us the advance notice. It was a 5-year funding project program, and that ends next year. It's going to be very hard to find another sponsor. We may look to try and find multiple sponsors. We're looking for people with corporate social responsibility programs to look at older people as a serious investment in corporate social responsibility. Volunteers have gone up with the recession. I mean, one of the silver linings that is very black cloud is the fact that there are more people due to unemployment with time on their hands. We're getting some incredible volunteers. And that's enabling us, because I was talking to a journalist recently saying, well, how come if your funding is falling and your work is going up, how does that tally? The answer is volunteers to a large degree. But most remarkable quality of volunteers. We have had to take the pain. Last year, our staff took wage cuts. We had 2 weeks unpaid leave, and we had the company suspended its contribution to staff pensions. That's been reinstated this year on the basis that we think we've got finance okay for 2012. The board has told us that they reserve the right to reinstate those cuts again if needs be. The board is conscious of the fact that people also have mortgages and also have all the other the difficulties, and a lot of charity staff wouldn't be paid that highly to start with. But that's where we are. The challenge is that, yes, there is more demand for services. People are in greater need. The information
are you seeing? I mean, if you give the simplistic nature of this question, I mean, we obviously know Donald dealing with people on social welfare would necessarily see an increase in the demand for his services, but there are always a steady number of older people throughout the generations. Are you seeing an increase in demand for Age Action services?
I think we're seeing a lot more older people who are isolated, certainly a lot older people who are struggling to heat their homes. Fuel poverty is an issue. People living alone is an issue. Certainly with immigration, we're seeing a lot more older people whose families have left the country. That creates huge problems, because that with those families go all the supports that families provide for older people. So we're seeing those kind of difficulties. And I think the other difficulty we're seeing is some of the media commentary which is going on, which is trying to play older people off against younger people. There's a lot of intergenerational tension coming in. People are very, very worried with all the speculation as to what's going to happen in December. I think there's more of it again this morning in some of the Sunday papers, that there's quite a severe tranche of cuts coming down the tracks for older people. Unfortunately, one of the problems with ageing is as you get older, your options, your choices reduce. And many older people we represent, their options have run out. They're dependent on the state for their state pension, which they've contributed to all their life. They're depending on it for healthcare, for transport. And if these things are gone, they don't have any option. And that's the big difficulty we're facing, and trying to manage that fear and trying to work with people to support them as best we can.
And Niamh, the Simon community dealing with homeless people, obviously with an economic crash as we've had, we would imagine more people are going to be homeless, both for due to financial reasons but also due to the psychological pressures that can bring on families and the rest. So you've seen an increase in demand for your services, I'm sure. If in the recession you receive state funding, do you think that if you receive less from the state, you can make up the shortfall through your private fundraising?
Well, I suppose just to say, you know, and to echo the concerns that have been expressed, we're very concerned going into Budget 2013. We certainly are seeing increasing demands, and we're seeing increasing pressure on our services all around the country. We have received cuts across a range of budget lines. Our communities are funded in a range of different ways through a range of different statutory sources. And we are absolutely supplementing statutory funding with our fundraising activities. We have, I suppose, upped our ante in terms of our fundraising activities to try and ensure that we can continue to do that. But I suppose people are all under pressure. So although people remain very, very generous, people have less to give. That's just a reality.
Have you seen an increase in your private funding?
We're maintaining the status quo in terms of our private fundraising. I suppose that's the position at the moment, but we're concerned moving into the future. Similarly to what Eamon said about the CSR funding, we'd have a range of very, very supportive companies that we work with around the country. But again, they're under huge pressure around their CSR budgets. So we're concerned looking to the future. And I suppose our key thing is that we are definitely seeing the increase. When people first become under pressure, they don't turn to homeless services. They rely on friends and family. They stay with other people. They borrow. They do a range of different things. So what we're seeing now is that slow trickle into homeless services. We're seeing increase in people rough sleeping, but we're also seeing some kind of poorly thought through policy approaches. So, for example, around supplement, the rent supplement threshold was reduced in January 2012. And what that is doing is it's putting huge pressure on people who are already very vulnerable. So people are topping up their rent supplement amount out of their own very scarce resources, and they're doing without food, they're doing without basic necessities. Some of those people won't be able to keep that up and they will end up in homeless services. But equally, it's also putting pressure on people moving out of homelessness, because the private rental sector is actually a viable option for a lot of people. Mm. But on the current amounts, they can't afford to do so. So you've got two arms of the state, one where there's a commitment from this government to end long-term homelessness, and then you've got this particular government policy which is preventing people moving out of homelessness.
Have the Simon community seen a cut in, so far, in their state funding?
We've received cuts across a range of different budget lines, yes, since 2008.
And so have the Simon community full-time staff, have they taken any pay cuts?
What we've done is a range of different things. So there's a pay freeze in operation since 2009. We've also got a non-replacement in terms of staffing. So we're lucky that we've got a very committed staff, so people have taken on additional responsibilities. We've had to be very creative in terms of managing that, and I suppose very innovative across that. And in addition, similarly to what the others mentioned, we have amazing volunteers. 2,000 plus people volunteer with us across the country, and they continue to supplement and to assist us, whether it's helping us range fundraising activities or supporting our service provision, befriending services, our soup runs, etc., etc. We wouldn't be able to continue doing what we're doing without that huge support.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak to Audrey about the impact of the recession on the St Vincent de Paul. But just a few texts from Martha. I think it's testimony to the great work of these people that they are here on a Sunday afternoon, and fair play to them all. Paul said that, do the panel think the people who work deserve more? Why should someone on the minimum wage take almost exactly the same home as somebody on social welfare? We'll leave that as an open question there. And John from Coolock, does St Vincent de Paul monitor what people get? If there are scammers out there, how do you know who they are? We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. And hello, good afternoon, and welcome back. My name is Keith Redman. Today I'm joined by four representatives of the charity sector. I'm joined by Donald Costello from the Clondalkin Citizens Information Centre, by Eamon Timmins, spokesperson for Age Action, by Niamh Randall, national spokesperson for the Simon community, and by Audrey Dean, spokesperson for St Vincent de Paul. Before the break, we were discussing the impact that the recession has had on the various charities, and we're going to come to our final guest, Audrey Dean. The recession has two effects, one would imagine, both on the demand for services and then also on the amount of money that you're receiving both from the state and private sources. But there was an interesting article in the Cork Examiner where somebody from the St Vincent de Paul, David Holden, said that there'd been an increase in the amount of money that the St Vincent de Paul had received from private donations. Is that a symptom of the kind of solidarity and good feeling that we have toward our fellow man in a recession?
Well, I think there's the lazy, easy answer would be yes. Against a backdrop of a huge increase in demand for our services, the calls for assistance to our national office and also the regional office, because we're very regionally oriented. Our whole structure is in the parishes, in the communities. So I wouldn't have an absolute up-to-date figure on absolutely every office, but there has been just, exponentially high up it goes, and particularly for households with children and particularly for lone parents. And it's quite clear that these are the groups that have taken the brunt of the austerity cuts in the last two budgets, and God only knows what's going to happen in early December this year. They're vulnerable cohorts, and they have been picked off. So it's no surprise to us that there's been a huge increase in just ask, please, for help from those groups.
Are you heartened by the response?
Oh, yes, we are. And I can't give you, it does vary from region to region, but what I do want to make sure that people understand is that if you give locally, it stays local. And I think that's, in a way, one of the magic things about the Vincent de Paul, because it is quite a magic organisation. Like, the amount of commitment and passion that people give, like any volunteers, you're all nodding at me around this table, that, like, people just get out there on a rainy Monday night, whether it's a soup run or whether it's going into a tough enough area and maybe having an awkward encounter with somebody in the kitchen. And let's be honest, talking about the fact that there are people who are scamming the system, deep in your heart, you might be thinking that, is this family genuine or is it not? But you know what? I mean, it's a very boring, old-fashioned thing, but it is a Sunday, so I will say it. The guy who founded the Vincent de Paul, and it was 200 years ago, he said that no act of charity is foreign to this organisation. And that is still true today, because I think the majority of the 10,300 people who are SVP members are there because they want to make a difference, an awful cold, excuse me. They want to make a difference and they just get out there and do it. And I think there's an awful lot of decent people in this country who recognise that charities are doing that in a very hostile, very competitive environment. And I think, you know, that there comes a point where people just say, right, let's just do something. Either we vote with our feet and get in and do it ourselves. We've had huge increases. When we put out an appeal, we're quite likely, we have a very active fundraising outfit in our national office. But we also have hugely committed individuals regionally who get out and do a Dun Stores backpack. And Jesus, they'll be there all day. And they'll batter their granny out to help them do it on the till next to them. You know, the sort of thing.
What has been the impact of the cuts in state funding to St Vincent de Paul?
Well, we have a very small core. I think it's just 1.2 million from the government to help us with core admin costs.
So it's never really been a large part of your fundraising?
No, we have always been dependent on donations, on wills, on specific...
your shops?
Oh, yeah, indeed. Shops, we have some shops and they're doing very well. And Eamon, I take your point that it's getting, even that climate is getting more competitive, but they serve a very, very vital function. We also have hostels. Now, they do get specific HSC funding from the homeless services, and I can't give the exact details on that. It's not my area. But generally,
so would it be fair to say that you're not as fearful of state cuts as the other guys here are, because you never really depended on them in the first place?
No, that's absolutely correct. What we do depend on is the generosity of the Irish public, and we are very specific in our fundraising requests, particularly around Christmas. We'd just be gobsmacked by the generosity. We'd have couriers coming in with companies just, you know, doing whip-arounds, giving trees for children. But it shouldn't just be a Christmas. And I think there's an awful lot of people who are, if they're lucky enough to still have a job, realise how lucky enough that they still have jobs and still have the means to get out and earn their living. And they are very conscious of that they're... But for the grace of God, go I. And people are, you know, we all know that Irish people are innately extremely generous. I don't know if that's a chromosomal thing, but it's true. It's actually really, really true.
You mentioned there that it's becoming a more competitive industry, if you forgive that word.
Yeah, no, it is. It's
and
a sector.
So would it be fair to say that the four of you guys here are probably in competition with each other for funding?
I don't think so, because... No, we're not.
Like, for example, would you lobby, I mean, not necessarily St Vincent de Paul, maybe I'll address this to Niamh. I mean, would the Simon community be lobbying the state to, you know, not cut us, cut others?
Well, no, because then you get caught into that whole sector of the deserving and the non-deserving and the
absolutely.
More deserving. And I just don't think that that's very useful.
No.
What we would be saying is this government has committed to protect those who are most vulnerable, and they need to keep that commitment. And of those who are most vulnerable, obviously people who are homeless and people who don't have a roof over their head, they would fall under that category. But equally so, the people who work with Vincent de Paul, older people and people who visit citizen information centres are also very much in need and very much deserving. So no, we would not be saying that.
Okay. Eamon, we've had a text here from Mick from Fairview. He said, I'd like to know what the people on the panel think about the charities that proposition people on the street and put them under pressure to sign up to direct debits. Do you think, this is a pet hate of Mick, do you think that that's an appropriate way to fundraise, or do you think that it's really putting people under too much pressure?
A difficult position in that one, Keith, because Age Action doesn't do that. Our board had decided, obviously it was a pet hate of some of our directors as well, that they didn't want to go that route. Wearing the general charity sector hat, I think if it is a way of raising funds, and a lot of what the charity muggers, the chuggers as they're called, I don't like some of the tactics they use to stop people. But if at the end of the day they get standing orders from people who do, having weighed up the cause, people don't sign up for a standing order without weighing up the cause, that's a vital form of funding for those charities that do it. But Age Action doesn't do it. And I think the average standing order, I think people keep them for 2 to 3 years. So it's a valuable source of funding. A lot of charities spend a lot of time, resources, actually trying to raise money.
Yep.
And they really shouldn't be. And I think any charity, even the charities doing that, know that really they should be, if they could get that money in an easier way, they would be concentrating their efforts on the services they're providing. Unfortunately, that's never been the way for most charities. We don't do charity muggers, but I understand why they're there. Personally, it's a pet hate of mine as well.
I actually personally don't mind. I'm a voluntary victim of a chugger for Concern and Sightsaver. So, I mean, I actually think it's a valid way of trying to fundraise, as long as people aren't being put under too much pressure.
I was just going to add, Vincent de Paul, we don't do the stopping people in the street, but having said that, we do sometimes link our advocacy with fundraising. And last year we chose the issue of frequent school book edition changes that parents, particularly at second level, get totally hammered for. And we exposed, quite frankly, the rather sharp practices of the publishing industry. And we did an online petition, and it really struck a chord with parents who just one more time had been shelling out hundreds of euros and can't pass the books on, and all this, quite frankly, nonsense. And it was a very profit.
What kind of examples of sharp practice did you find?
Well, we found that there is some very, very direct lobbying at staff rooms in schools by particular. It's a business. Let's be honest, it is a business, and we're not here to knock jobs in business, but very competitive competition between the various. There aren't that many publishers. It's pretty well a cartel. There's three or four with one or two outliers going to say, this is our best book, this is refreshed, it's got a new graphic on page 13. And no offence to teachers, but they're very busy people. And at times, you just want everybody in the classroom fun. You had to have the same book open on the same page on the 3rd of September. So it's rather easy to go for the, let's just get the new book. And to be honest, school book rental schemes have not been a very, very promoted model within the Department of Education's approach to giving money to schools. So we went for that.
Why do you think that is?
Because there wasn't enough money. Having said that, 16 million of taxpayers' money has been channeled via the Department of Education into schools for school books. Now, we don't think that's enough. But what we do expect is that the minister, who did listen to us, because to be honest, 9,000 people signed our petition. And the reason I brought that in there is that over 6,000 of them chose to be updated by us by email every quarter. And there's the odd soft request to them. Would you like to help our backpacker? Would you like to? So in a way, I think we're about relationship building with donors. To show, look, we're into social justice solutions that will help everybody, and if you want to be part of that, join us. So that's what I think. Sometimes people just want to be energetic, they want to be involved, and if you ask them to engage with you, they'll meet you halfway.
Okay, Eamon, I just want to come to a quote from Minister Brian Hayes when he was speaking about the upcoming cuts in the budget, and he mentioned that there are well-off pensioners out there who haven't yet shared their burden in this recession. What's your reaction to that?
Well, Brian Hayes' ears must have been burning. On the 17th of September, we launched our national petition to protect the dignity of older people in the forthcoming budget. And it was the Monday after Brian Hayes' comments, where he made them on the front page of the Irish Times and again on RTE. And the general, to sum up our members, the 200 members that attended the launch, the general belief is that Brian Hayes is completely out of touch with reality. Certainly we all know some older people who are wealthy, but most older people are not wealthy. In fact, the CSO figures, and we'd really encourage the minister to look at the CSO figures, the EU Silk figures, which came out earlier this year, which showed that the majority of older people are in the bottom four income deciles. Only 5% of older people are in the top income decile, and that's 39,000 plus. So the vast majority of older people are on fairly low to middle income.
But in fairness to Minister Hayes, was he not specifically speaking about those well-off pensioners?
Well, I think this was an example of what we were talking about earlier, of trying to target older people and build intergenerational strife. He didn't talk about wealthy engineers. He didn't talk about wealthy people living in Wexford or wealthy people living in Galway. He talked about wealthy pensioners. Most older people are not wealthy.
But those other cohorts that you mentioned don't receive large state funding. They don't receive packages with respect to their television license, their electricity. Yeah. They don't receive any of those other issues. He's looking at the kind of cutting bottom line figures, would it not be fair to say that the universality of, for example, those packages perhaps has to be called into question for wealthier pensioners?
I think what it highlighted was that Brian Hayes' lack of understanding of what it means to be an older person, because in the same interview he also said they don't have mortgages, therefore they're well off. Mm. And I think a lot of older people responded and said, we don't have mortgages because we paid them off during our working life, and we paid 60 and 70% tax, and also paid for our children to go to third level education.
But some of them have medical cards, and
some of them do have medical cards. Anybody on an income of up to 36,000 has a medical card.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to have to get realistic about that.
But it is, but then Audrey, it takes the presumption that older people are like anybody else, that they don't have any greater medical need than anybody else. The reality is that 57% of older people have a chronic illness, a third live with a disability.
I would not contest that.
And if you ask older people how is their health, they'll say it's great. I mean, the latest survey, they think the Pfizer Health Index came out last week. 70-80% of old people say their health is good. Good to very good. Now, despite the fact that they have that level of disability and chronic illness, but that means that it's being managed and being treated properly.
72% of older people have a medical card, and we saw the impact that Fianna Fáil's attempt to reduce the entitlement of medical cards to a very small percentage of older people brought thousands of older people out on the streets.
I can correct you. What Fianna Fáil was hoping to do, and when they did, they had to reverse it, but what Fianna Fáil were going to do if they got the way, €280 was the limit they introduced on Budget Day. If they had got that way, they would have taken medical cards off a lot of older people. In actual fact, they had to bring it back up because of the protests. But no, what brought those people out in the street wasn't the fact that they were going to means test. They were going to means test and take it from almost everybody.
But you mentioned earlier that older people feel that they've paid high taxes throughout their lives, they've paid off their mortgages, and therefore they feel that they shouldn't be touched in this recession. Do you think that older people should share any burden in the recession?
Older people have... This is another of the myths that are out there. There are the myths that, A, that older people, most of them are wealthy, and also that they haven't been touched by austerity measures. In our budget before, a pre-budget submission last year, we listed over 20 cuts that older people had sustained. It's only got worse since then.
But they cut the same, and you have to be honest, that it's working, you know, it's working age people and children who have borne the brunt, and I'm talking about the wider scale of, that is uncontested. And there's no point in talking about what happened. Well, I just feel that there's no point. I mean, my parents tell me all the time that they paid interest rates of 17% in their mortgage throughout that. I mean, we didn't have a bean in our house. But I'm just saying, these are discontinuous times. This country is on the verge of oblivion, and they're going to have to be very, very tough decisions made, particularly regarding the health budget. And I just would be very fearful that the right, you know, that the decisions are made that will protect our most vulnerable. And that may mean... And I only mean may mean shaving back from some of the better off older people.
We all make soothing noises about intergenerational solidarity and all of these things, but really talk is cheap when it comes down to the fact that money is going to have to be taken from somebody. That's the bottom line. Earlier on, Audrey, you mentioned that the social welfare budget would have to be trimmed in some way. You've mentioned there specifically that wealthier pensioners would have to see some kind of cut to protect, as you see it, the people who've been hit hardest.
Actually, I didn't say Eamon that. There will be cuts across the board. I think, Eamon, I think you'd probably agree that there will be changes, and I think there's going to be an absolute scythe.
But you were advocating there that... older people who can afford to would perhaps take
a
larger proportion.
I actually said anybody who can afford to, and by that I mean in the corporate sector, I mean in widening the tax band, and I really probably also mean people who can afford to pay an unwelcome property tax and an unwelcome water tax. I mean, the sort of carry on you hear about people giving out about the amount of leakage, therefore they're not going to pay their water tax, and let's not talk now with 10 minutes to the hour about the household charge, but we've got to get real. I mean, let's go back to Fianna Fáil in 1977 when they withdrew local taxation from communities. That was the biggest mistake ever made from the point of view of making people understand.
They got a landslide victory as a result of it.
Of course they did. And we've been voting for them ever since. And who did they vote for during the boom? Who made the crazy policies that have cut so many and have long-term impact?
We've received several text messages from people who say, in as much as we have sympathy, in effect, this is the summary, in as much as we have sympathy for people who are reliant on charity, the so-called coping classes, the people who are in work paying their taxes, who are on the brink themselves, cannot afford any more tax rises. And it's an easy thing to say, just tax them more. No, do you have any sympathy for the people who are paying the tax that funds all of this?
Absolutely. And I actually feel and there's an awful lot of people bandying. I mean, what's the percentage of people earning over 100,000 in this country and how they should be taxed? And I think
it's a very small percentage.
It is a small number. So I think we all get kind of hyped up and we all get very angry and it has to be somebody else except me or my cohort. But really, it's not really about individual taxation. It's about much more structural reform needed and compliance and sanctioning with regard to tax avoidance at a much larger frame. And it is, unfortunately, we're going to have to be realistic about property taxes and reform and efficiencies within the public service, and that does include allowances.
Eamon, do you think that older people should be exempt from the property taxes on the basis that they may be living in nice houses, but at the moment they're kind of income poor and that they don't earn the salaries anymore? Do you think they should be exempt?
I think we made a submission to the Department of the Environment. We made an oral presentation to them as well, and we looked at this. And our big concern is that property tax of any section in society is going to have the biggest impact on older people, because the majority of older people own their own homes. The majority of older people no longer have the income they had when they bought those homes. They're now on quite humble incomes, and how do you get blood out of a stone? So we looked at four elements to our pre-budget, to our submission to the government on property tax. One, that there should be a basic income limit below which people don't pay property, below which people don't pay property tax. That should be across the board, people of any age. Then we looked at kind of some of the models in the United States where they have circuit breakers, where nobody pays over a set percentage of an income towards property tax. Mm-hmm. We also looked at other concerns we have in places like...
So you've moved on from it being a tax on the property to being a tax on income. So isn't effect, is a sneaky income tax.
Well, all these taxes are sneaky income taxes. I mean, you know, water taxes. They're all, you know, the form. At the end of the day, it's the government is trying to get more money.
But they're allegedly taxes for services received. And you're saying, really, you want to see a more income-based method of working out who pays the tax.
Well, I think what we're saying is that we don't see older people should be exempt because they're older people, but it should be based on their income. You know, if they can't afford, if they don't have the income, well, then you are going to get blood out of it. You can't get blood out of a stone.
There were some suggestions that the tax could be levied, and if it wasn't payable, that it would be levied on the property, and they could be paid then to the state when the person dies. What would you think of that?
We've seen that with the Fair Deal. Older people already have that form of charging when it comes to the nursing home. Not all older people, only the sickest and the most vulnerable. Only the sickest pay the what they call the Fair Deal. It was a very, very, I would say, kind of ironic kind of title for, that you pay one form of charging if you have dementia or a stroke for a nursing home. You pay a different form of charging if you have a heart attack or cancer. But this is specifically, it's many older people who are paying the Fair Deal. They already have this charge on their homes. They pay up to 15% of the value of their homes towards their nursing home bed if they can't afford it when they're alive. The department put that question directly to us. Would you not have a deferred charge?
What was your answer?
Well, we're saying it hasn't worked with the Fair Deal.
So you're not in favour of it?
Well, what the Fair Deal has actually done is delayed people. It's kept people. We saw the figures last week. It's kept 680 people. The biggest cause of keeping people in delayed discharge beds in acute hospitals is they're waiting to process their Fair Deal application because it's so complex.
So you think that older people should be exempt from paying for local services?
You could have a death tax. We had a death tax. A death tax would be
in effect,
fair.
This
we're
would
all
be
going
death
to
tax.
Die.
In effect, this would be a death tax.
Well, would there be a number of death tax? At the moment, I mean, the only people who stand at the graveside to collect money at the moment are the Criminal Assets Bureau and people who've been in a nursing home for the Fair Deal. We have an issue with that. We never thought it was fair to charge people because it's a different form of charging for
Would you be against inheritance taxes as well?
We don't have an issue with inheritance taxes, no. But what we're saying is you can't get blood out of a stone. You can't take money from people who don't have the money to give you. And I think that's what we're saying to the government is if you're going to have a property tax, it needs to be a realistic tax. Otherwise, it's just not going to work.
Okay, just a text message from Betty. Betty thinks that the medical card shouldn't really be for younger people because they don't have medical problems. If they have medical problems, she's in favour of it. But if you don't have a medical problem, you shouldn't have it because workers have to pay 50 to 60 euro per visit. Audrey, we come back to this intergenerational thing. You know, Eamon's just said that older people should be exempt from paying taxes for local services unless they have the income. They shouldn't have the charge levied on their
people
homes.
People of any age, Keith, not just older people. People of any age.
No, but what you're saying specifically is that they shouldn't even pay. They shouldn't be levied on the property. In effect, they shouldn't be paying at any stage.
We're saying people of any age, if you don't have the income, if you're on income of less than 18,000, there's no point saying pay a property tax.
But the tax could be levied on the property and the money could be received from the state that way. Mm. But Audrey, what would Sir Vincent de Paul... Sir Vincent de Paul, I would imagine you look after people of every age, but you seem to be suggesting that perhaps there should be some kind of broadening of that tax base to share the burden. Would that be fair?
I do, but my key message for anybody listening to us today is that we have got to embrace reform. And we saw Roisin Shortall stepping out of government last week because she was so frustrated with the lack of pace of change and reform. And that reform is going to start changing the way people actually get into a GP surgery without parting with 50 or 60 euros, which is quite incredible. And we are practically alone in Europe for having that structure of financing health services. We've got to just grow up and move out of the junior infants class of civics or social responsibility. That's my key message for people, and we have got to take the pain of that. And that does mean that anybody who can afford to take it will have to pay, because quite frankly, if you're on a social welfare payment or you're on the low paid cohort, you can't afford. And I would agree with Eamon that there are an awful lot of people who might be living in rather large houses, but they can't heat them and they can't move out, and if they get sick they're in fear of their lives. So we've got to just grow up and start doing the reforms. And this government got in on a big promise to widen access to primary care, which is going to your GP and other services, to change the whole structure. And what we haven't seen it yet. The 56,000 people on the long term illness scheme, they're a very vulnerable group. They need medication to stay well. A lot of them have chronic conditions. It can be epilepsy. It can be a lot of things. I don't think asthma is included there. But they've been promised that they would have access to a GP free. That's gone to ground. Mm. There's been no...
I just want to come, before we finish, I just want to come to Donald. Donald, with the budget coming up, what would you like to see, the Clondalkin Citizen Advice Centre, what would you like to see, some proactive steps that would help you in your work?
I suppose the main thing would be not to cut us back any further.
Is there anything non-monetarily that the state could be doing to help?
No, I think, from our point of view, as I say, We have two sets of resources. One is monetary and the other is voluntary. And we just continue to do our best to recruit in terms of volunteer resources.
So the take-home message is don't cut us anymore?
Absolutely.
Okay. And Niamh, the one issue that a few text messages have come through, but an issue that annoys a lot of people are the cost bases in charities. Okay, there was an article again in the Irish Examiner which said that of the 24 charities canvassed, the pay scale for the chief executive ranged from 100,000 to 150,000 euro. A lot of the organisations are quite opaque about what they pay their staff and what they pay individual staff members. And one of them for this article was the Simon community. Why does the Simon community not want to share its pay scales?
We have shared our pay scales. We have shared our pay scales with the range. There's been a number of articles in recent times.
What does the chief executive earn?
The head of our office earns, I think it's 75,000. But I'm not absolutely sure, but it's in the region of 70 to 75,000.
Do you think that people who are giving money to their charities should have a very transparent view of the kind of cost bases that are behind these charities?
Absolutely, and I think we are very open and we're very transparent across the Simon communities in relation to that. And I think the majority of charities around the country are also very open and clear about it. I think people, if they're supporting a charity, are entitled to get that information, and I think most charities are very happy to share that.
Would you be in favour of a mandated percentage of your income being for the running costs, or do you think that the running costs should be independent of the amount of money you raise?
Well, I mean, I think that you have to approach that in a more, I don't think you can have a mandated piece, because I think it depends on what the charity is doing. It depends on the type of service it's providing. It depends on, you know, if it's an advocacy organisation versus a service-driven organisation. So I don't think you can approach it in that way, but I do think openness and transparency is hugely important.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. I'd like to apologise to all the texters who sent them. We got a lot of texts on this. We just couldn't get to you all, but we'd like to thank you all for your texts, and certainly they're all read. I'd like to thank my guests, Donald Costello from the Clondalkin Citizens and Information Centre, Eamon Timmins, spokesperson for Age Action, Niamh Randall, spokesperson for the Simon community, and Audrey Dean, spokesperson for St Vincent de Paul. You've been listening to Between the Lines. My name is Keith Redmond. We'll see you next Sunday, and thanks of course to the great Ray Burke on sound.